Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. If you desire to speak to the host, please press 1 at any time, and the host will be notified that there is a caller in queue. Otherwise, please hold and you will be able to listen to the show.
Pleasant hum that lulls you into a state of relaxation if you do hear it, but we will trudge on forward either way. Someone sent an article to me recently, and this is actually from last summer, but for some reason I had not encountered this until very recently, and I've got to share it with you. You know, the vaccine issue and issues of corruption and deceit that go on, not only in the vaccine arena, but in many other areas of our lives pertaining to our health or otherwise, these are some really dark issues, and when you reach a point in your life where you are open to the possibility that maybe the world doesn't operate the way it appears to operate on the surface or the way that we are always told, you begin to recognize that there are some very serious underlying problems, and these are not pleasant or fun things to encounter, to contemplate, or to deal with. So you got to find your humor where you can, and I think it's important from time to time that we take time out and unplug from the darker aspects of our world to recognize that there are some absolutely wonderful bright lights on the planet as well as dark corners. And so always great to acknowledge some of those things. But in any event, here's an article. This is, maybe it's humorous, I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish the humor from the truly sad or disturbing. But in any case, the title of the article, Sanofi Pasteur, which is a pharmaceutical company, Sanofi Pasteur is on the hunt for the, are you ready for this, for the flugitives this flu season. Flugitives. I guess that's their attempt at humor. I'm not laughing at their attempt at a pun, at their pun. I'm laughing at their attempt at a pun more than anything else. It's like, come on, give me a break. So this is just another in the ongoing series of ways to try to cast people with an so-called alternative view on vaccines in a negative light. We're flugitives. They have to track us down. Oh, I don't even know if this is worth spending any more than a few seconds on. I don't want to dignify the intent and direction of this article in such a way, but you know, there's no need to be a flugitive this year. Speak with your healthcare provider about vaccination and your vaccination options. Oh, gosh. The flugitives are encouraged to come out of hiding, round up other flugitives, and turn themselves in to their health care provider to learn about the seriousness of influenza and their available vaccine options. Now, I'm not going to suggest that influenza is never serious, but, you know, so is the vaccine. And by any reasonable objective measure, in my humble but adamant opinion, the vaccines are far more serious concern than the flu is, at least overall. And we've talked about that extensively. We'll probably talk about that some today and in the future, especially as we are now in and going through the several months that at least one or more parts of the country during late summer, fall, and early winter consider to be the prime flu vaccination season. And because this is a time of year when the issue is of particular concern to healthcare employees, healthcare workers, healthcare professionals, because hospitals around the country are increasingly mandating flu vaccines as a condition of employment. And so at the risk of sounding like a broken record on this during the flu season, I just want to mention this, that folks, in my experience, and I've worked with healthcare workers all over the U.S., from the East Coast all the way out to Hawaii, the vast majority of hospitals, when they implement these mandates, they do implement religious and medical exemption policies, but they are overstepping legal boundaries far more often than not in being overly restrictive. So if you're a healthcare worker or you know any healthcare workers or you have any opportunity to put word out somewhere on Facebook or word of mouth or whatever is available to you to spread the word to healthcare workers around the U.S. that most of these policies are unlawfully restrictive, and you do not have to read a policy and then stop right there. Oh, that policy says I have to have a member of the clergy confirm that, you know, our church has tenets opposed to vaccines. Many policies are saying things like that, or that you have to have a member of the clergy write a letter or sign a form. These things are all unlawful. Employers may not lawfully put in those kinds of requirements, but hospitals all over the country are doing things like that. There's a long list of things where hospitals will overstep legal boundaries in one or more of these areas, and usually if they overstep one, they overstep two or three or four. So let the healthcare workers around the country know that there are ways to legally avoid these vaccines at work, and they do not necessarily have to comply with their employer's policy requirements, because more often than not, these policy requirements violate the law. The state of North Carolina just implemented a flu vaccine mandate for the state's healthcare workers, the public healthcare workers. It's not a statute requiring all healthcare workers in the state, but the state employees, some 10,000 of them, now all have to get flu shots. Their policy violates federal law and state constitutional law here as well, in my opinion. So we're not stuck necessarily with what they give us. If you're a healthcare worker in a hospital or other healthcare facility being required to get flu vaccines, and so there's the best starting place, if I may say so, is my own website, vaccinerights.com. So send folks to that website. Let them know about this. There's a lot of misinformation on the internet. Somebody posted not long ago this lengthy article about here's how to avoid vaccines in the workplace. And everything they said to say and do are exactly the things that are most likely to get you rejected. When people try this on their own, there is a very low success rate because the way the law works is not consistent with most people's common sense approach. And because hospitals have unlawfully, overly restrict policies. So I apologize if this is offensive to anyone in that it is self-serving or potentially self-serving. All I can tell you about that is I do what I do. I went back to school after 17 years, and I picked law school because of my concern about the vaccine issue. I don't make a great living at this. My goal is not to see how much money I can make. My goal is to see how many people I can help. And there isn't anybody else in the country who has worked with hundreds of healthcare workers around the country on this issue, as far as I know. So, and I am a lot less expensive than other attorneys too. So I really am a good option. But work with an attorney, whether it's me or somebody else. Don't try this on your own at a hospital unless you're just really super clear about what you're doing and the law and how it works, because most people who try it on their own fail. I have heard repeatedly, but here's one example, where a client says that an administrator at the hospital told her that the hospital system, so this would be a group of hospitals, the system had received over 1,000 requests for exemptions and the hospital allowed 4. I don't for a second think that only 4 people qualified under the law, but this is a typical example of what your chances are of succeeding when you try this on your own. So I really, really encourage folks to look further. Go to vaccinerights.com as a starting place, or check with a local attorney if you can find one knowledgeable in this area. So enough of blowing my own horn here. Let me push on to some other things. I saw something really wonderful I want to read to you. This came to me by way of an email from a vaccine rights advocate. And it was a quote from a medical doctor in New York City by the name of Kelly Brogdon. And I thought it was just so such a wonderful quote here that I want to just read it to you verbatim. So, Dr. Brogdon says, "It has long been my contention that those who question the science, safety, and recommendations around vaccination are the most learned on the subject." Gosh, it's hard for me not to pause here and just read that again or make a comment on it, because this is what is so fascinating and at the same time so frustrating. The quote-unquote authorities will dismiss the anti-vaccine people all in one swoop by saying, oh, they're misinformed, they have all this crazy nonsense information. Dr. Brogdon says, we are actually, on the whole here, the more informed people. And that's been my experience as well. The people who dismiss out of hand concerns about vaccines will do so without, far more often than not, without citing any reference or making any clear, coherent, intelligent argument in their support. They all just sort of rest on this general notion that, oh, we're the authority, so whatever we say is the truth, end of story. You know, and if it only really was that simple and straightforward, we wouldn't have the debate and dispute that we have had in this country for decades, but increasingly so in very recent years. It's long been my contention, Dr. Kelly Brogdon, I think I said Brogdon, it looks like Brogan, B-R-O-G-A-N, my apologies, Dr. Brogdon, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly or not, so I'll just apologize again and move on in case I'm missing that. Kelly Brogdon, B-R-O-G-A-N, medical doctor in New York. My colleagues, particularly MDs, who have come to a place of concern, frustration, and determination around reform of this practice, have spent tireless hours educating themselves on everything there is to be known about these mandated pharmaceutical products. Far from being uneducated, defiant, and dangerous, vaccine dissenters understand immunology, natural history of disease, and the true requirements for the practice of safe and informed medicine. Dr. Humphreys and Mr. Bistrianic have assembled an awe-inspiringly thorough and comprehensive text that supports, with primary evidence, the inefficacy and danger of the most commonly treasured vaccines. It is impossible for me to imagine that a dedicated reader could turn the last page of this book and not feel that the lights have finally been turned on. Do not step into an injecting physician's office without doing this homework. This is information your doctor never had access to and likely never will. And it's referring to a book titled Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. This is a pretty new book just out earlier this year by Suzanne Humphreys, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrianic. And I tell you, I haven't had time to read the book yet, but I have seen comments such as this one, and reviews and so forth, and I am of the and I am familiar. I'm acquainted with Dr. Humphreys myself directly, and I am of the impression that this is just an incredible book for getting a good, thorough overview of the history of vaccines, where we are, and how we got here. And I can tell you from my own years of research of this topic, which I'm sure does not go into the level of depth, clarity, and insight that this book does with regard to the history of vaccines. But nonetheless, the extent to which I have covered some of these issues on my own, I come to some very profound and disturbing conclusions, and I suspect they are quite similar to those of Dr. Brogan and Dr. Humphreys and Mr. Bistrionic in terms of their book. So, again, just want to call to your attention the existence of that book, Dissolving Illusions. It's available, terrific book to read if you want to know where we are, how we got here, what the science has said all along that we do not hear from our so-called health authorities. Tentative conclusion, and frankly more than a tentative conclusion on my part at this point personally, that the pharmaceutical industry controls the media, the mainstream media anyway, or whoever controls the mainstream media also controls the pharmaceutical industry. Not sure exactly which way that goes, but either way, the result's the same. You will not hear criticism of vaccines on mainstream media beyond very minimal, superficial references. You will hear all kinds of propaganda on the mainstream media touted as fact, but which is easily refuted by credible scientific sources. So there is clearly and well-documented corruption within the media, within the state and federal health agencies, within the pharmaceutical industry. There are also wonderful people in all of those arenas as well. It's not black and white, but clearly serious problems. We talk about them all the time here on the show. I'm going to move on here. Let me see where I'm at here. I had somebody asking me a question a while back. I don't think I've addressed this previously here on this show, but if I have, perhaps a good reminder. And someone said that as of the end of July this year, all of the healthcare professionals in the state of New York have to either get an annual flu shot or wear a mask during flu season. And this is apparently a state requirement, state law or state health department requirement. The writer here wasn't clear on that point, or at least my notes are not clear on that point. Here we go. I'm sorry, I see something else here. It says regulation. So that would be the Department of Health in New York. Does this nullify the policies at New York hospitals? Hospitals all over the country that are mandating flu shots as a condition of employment, if the state is now saying you have to either get a shot or wear a mask, does that mean that the hospitals can't mandate the shot as a condition of employment? Well, it's an interesting question, and I'm not licensed in New York, so I want to, and we don't generally offer legal advice over the air or medical advice over the air. This is an educational program, so the obligatory disclaimer here, I'm not answering this question or responding to this question intending to give legal advice either generally or to anyone in particular specifically. So this is all educational exploration of the topics we discuss. Having said that, if a state says you have to get a flu shot or wear a mask, does that mean that a hospital can no longer mandate? I don't think so. Now, I don't think if the state says all the healthcare workers have to get a flu shot or wear a mask, I don't think a hospital can say we're not going to do that here. Nobody has to wear a mask or get a flu shot. I don't think you can conflict with a state law requirement as an employer. But I think there's nothing to keep you and your discretion as a business from asking for more. Okay, that's fine. Everywhere else, they have to at least get the shot or wear a mask. But here, if you want to work at our facilities, you do have to get, you know, mandated. It's not a question of get it or get a mask. You have to get the shot. Now, you know, they may also say, and if you qualify for one of our exemptions, you have to wear a mask. And just about every client I've ever worked with is in that situation. But believe it or not, I actually had one client who said the hospital had considered masks and decided there wasn't any medical basis, and so they didn't have a mask policy at all. I thought, my gosh, how refreshing, how wonderful to see that there's at least one hospital out of the roughly 5,800 registered hospitals in the country. There's at least one of them that has at least that part of their policy based on science and medicine. You know, even the CDC that recommends masks in certain situations acknowledges that the face mask is not, it'll stop large droplet particles from a cough or sneeze, but it's the webbing or netting there on a mask is not going to stop air from going in and out in something the size of a flu virus. You know, this is like, you know, can a bacterium fall through a fishnet? You know, viruses are whole orders of magnitude smaller than bacteria. You know, or can a piece of algae fall through a fishnet? You know, so it's just sort of crazy, the idea that a mask is really going to stop the spread of flu. I mean, if you're, let's say you're vaccinated with the flu, you know, from the flu, with a, you've gotten a flu vaccine, and let's say, just for the sake of discussion, that the flu vaccine actually worked and you are now immune from whatever strain or strains of the flu you were vaccinated against. Those are two very highly questionable points, but let's just give a benefit of the doubt and say you get a flu vaccine, didn't hurt you in any way, you're fully protected from the flu. Can you still transmit the flu? Well, let's see. If flu germs are sort of ubiquitous, they're in the air, they're on the doorknobs of anybody who sneezed and touched the doorknob, they're on the counter, they're, you know, everywhere. Can you, if you're immune to the flu, can you still breathe in and out a flu virus? Can you still get a virus on your hand when you open a door that has a virus on it, and then the next time you touch something, transmit the virus to that person or thing? You shake hands with someone, you touch a counter, you know, whatever. The idea that getting the flu vaccine, even if it works, and even if it doesn't hurt you, that you are now safe, and as long as everybody does that, there's going to be no flu transmission, is just ridiculous. And so that's why this whole thing has been set up. It's with hospitals. It's tied to Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements. The administrators do not have the luxury of deciding whether or not this makes sense medically, and this has been set up so that they don't have that option because they have to get their 90% vaccination rate or they're going to start losing part of their Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement. And I tell you, you know, there are lots of high salaries in the medical field, and that always comes first, but when you look at the hospitals themselves, you know, they operate on low profit margins. It's not a whole lot of money left over. They can't afford, you know, some hospitals, they're as much as maybe, I've been told, figures as high as 80% of their income comes from Medicaid and Medicare. You take 2% of that away, and you are talking, bring a hospital down to its knees. I mean, this is not something hospitals can afford to just sort of philosophically debate. And it's no accident that this has been set up that way because we have a long list of mainstream medical sources that tell us that the flu policy doesn't make sense medically and scientifically. Article earlier this year in the British Medical Journal saying that, OSHA, federal agency, saying that in 2011. Article last year, and I don't have it in front of me, but it's a peer-reviewed published journal saying there's just no credible support in the medical literature for these policies mandating a flu vaccine for healthcare workers. Scientifically and medically, at best, it is unclear. And if you screen through the propaganda, what you come up with, is really the vaccine is minimal effectiveness, but it can injure and kill you. So, anyway, enough on those points, I think. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. I'm Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips, speaking to you from the Vaccine Rights Studios in beautiful Asheville, North Carolina, where we have a very pleasant, if overcast, and cloudy day today here in Asheville. Coming up shortly, my co-host, founder of Homeopathy World Community, Debbie Brook, and special guest today, Greg Glazer. Hopefully he'll be checking in with us in the next few minutes, and we'll move right over to Greg. Greg's got some fascinating things to talk about today having to do with vaccines and health and the law and your rights and some of the underlying philosophical debates and discussions thereabouts. So definitely encourage you to stick around here. We're going to go to break shortly. Let me see if there's another quick point I can squeak in here before we get to break. I was talking a couple of weeks ago and actually drawing from an article I had written a little while back about the moral and ethical imperative for vaccine philosophical exemptions. As it pertains to school enrollment, more than half of U.S. citizens and parents in particular, but fewer than half of the U.S. states have access to or have or offer make available philosophical exemptions for school enrollment. So, depending on how you look at it, more or less than half of the U.S., more people, less than half states. And yet, when you consider some simple points, really, I mean, I go in depth in my article about a number of different points, but on the surface, the real simple points. Well, let's see. Vaccines cause injury and death. Federal government pays out $100 million a year to vaccine victims and their families. FDA and CDC have told us that only 1 to 10% of vaccine adverse events ever get reported, so we really have no idea. There's no hard numbers whatsoever about what the true extent of vaccine injury and death really is. So let's see. May or may not ever be exposed to the disease, or if you are exposed, you may or may not get sick, or if you do get sick, most of these diseases are, the childhood infectious diseases, are benign the vast majority of the time and actually strengthen the immune system, make you more resistant to cancer and other chronic diseases later. That's from the medical literature, so we know that's been scientifically demonstrated. But you can be injured or killed by the vaccine, and nobody really knows what the odds of that happening or how severe it'll be or whether it's going to happen right away or in a few weeks or months or years later. We have documented instances of people developing cancer from which they culture the what's called SV40, 40th simian virus 40, 40th virus they found contaminating the early polio vaccines that millions of people got. So we know there's a possible connection, and this happened literally decades after the people were vaccinated. So the adverse effects, who knows what they really are, what the scope is, but you can be injured or killed from a vaccine. So we cannot compare directly the risk of the disease versus the risk of the vaccine. There just is no data available. So should we, for purely philosophical reasons, have the option to say no, thank you, as our conscience may dictate or as the healthcare professional of our choosing may recommend? Absolutely we should. Absolutely we should. And the other really quick point, the pharmaceutical industry routinely engages in criminal behavior. This is not a slanted, opinionated, out-of-nothing sort of comment. This is established and documented. Criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars against the pharmaceutical industry, companies in that industry, are common, and criminal fines have been as high as $1 billion because they continue doing the same criminal behavior over and over again. Should anyone ever be required to take a product from an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior? That's not a deep philosophical question. you know, right on its face right there, the answer is a clear, resounding, uncontestable no. No, no one should ever be required, absolutely, to get a product from an industry whose companies, many companies, routinely get criminal fines, primarily for the illegal marketing of drugs, prescription drugs. So these are some very simple, straightforward points. And, you know, now that I have reiterated those points,
your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
Great.
So, there are some very clear arguments and many more for why we should never be required, absolutely, to get vaccines. There should always be, whatever other exemptions, there should always be a clear personal or philosophical exemption option, because no one should ever be absolutely required to get a vaccine for those and many other reasons. You're listening to Vaccine Your Rights in the U.S. We're going to go to break here. We'll be back in a few minutes with myself, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, but also Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Bruck, and our special guest today, Greg Glazer, attorney from California. Stick with us, folks. We've got lots to talk about today, and we're looking forward to going forward and having you with us to listen along or even engage in the conversation directly if you'd like to. The number, if you'd like to do that during the live show, where is it here? Area code 347-324-3704. That's area code 347-324-3704. And that number is available on the Freedomizer Radio homepage on the internet, freedomizerradio.com, Freedomizer Radio, freedomizerradio.com. We'll be back with you in just a few minutes, folks. Stick around.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures.
Hello, is this Alan? Is this Alan?
Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com.
But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Get ready for the epic new documentary adventure ride of your life. Shade, the motion picture. A view into the globalist domain. And Embellus and Burma's film.
Nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. Governments do not operate the way you think they do. Banks do not do what you think they do. The police department is not here for what you think it is. Nothing in your world works the way you think it does.
We let the West know that their world government has been identified, and they thought they just clone the world economy to bring in a worldwide police state, but instead it's going to bring them down.
You have to stand up. Speak up, speak out.
Shade the motion picture. Order your copy of the DVD today at ShadeTheMotionPicture.com.
This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance, available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you will ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
Does the media ever deceive the public?
A white plane, a very big jet, was flying in an unusual pattern near the White House over Lafayette Park. Very slowly, it made one circle and then...
Are the media and their sources trustworthy?
New York State and New Jersey will get their first doses of the swine flu vaccine.
The H1N1 virus has made thousands of people across the country sick. Many have died. And some worrying that it could grow into a full-blown pandemic.
Where does our mainstream media get their news?
All this enjoyment is brought to you by all the things sweetened with NutraSweet.
There's a reason why we want to own these guns.
We're going to have to come together and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this.
That was President Obama Friday suggesting it is now time to reopen the national debate on gun control.
The media tends to march in lockstep with the government.
Who is responsible when the media fabricates the news?
When the public is constantly fed messages that are potentially leading us into a war that may not be necessary, it's not fair to the American people, and it's not fair to journalism, because the truth isn't being told here. We found out that CNN International is actually making money from the Bahrain regime. They are a customer of Bahrain. Bahrain is paying CNN International to create content that shows Bahrain in a favorable light, to then air that content on CNN International.
Join us online at williamlewisfilms.com. That's williamlewisfilms.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Vaccines in Your Rights in the U.S. with special guest today, Greg Glaser. We'll bring him on in just a moment. Also, Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook, and yours truly, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. Let me see. Debbie first, are you with us?
Waving hello. We've got great. A really top-notch show. I'm looking forward to Greg's questions and his answers, too.
And if I understand correctly, he's going to let us take a shot at those answers, and then he's going to add something much more meaningful than what you and I will say, I feel sure, to clarify and enlighten us. Greg, how are you doing today? Terrific as always.
It's so nice to be on the air today. Thank you for having me.
Oh, our great pleasure.
We want folks to know that even though we are simulcasting on Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community, at the same time, we are on freedomizerradio.com, and if you do want to call in to talk with us or chat, you need to go to the Freedomizer Blog Talk Radio, call in to 347-324-3704, or on the freedomizerradio.com chat board.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, Greg, you want to just go ahead and... dive in. Tell us what you have planned for us today, because I understand from our email exchanges you have been busily preparing for today, and I'm, again, we're honored to have you, delighted to hear what you got for us.
All right, great. Yeah, I thought today we could talk about a topic called the way the world is versus the way we might want it to be. And what I'd like to do is ask you guys questions, and as well as ask anyone listening, if you want to call in, to answer the question. And the question that I'll ask is, how would you like the world to be? And then after you answer, then I'll chime in with any examples that I have about the way the world actually is, to show some of our grittier bureaucracies and more cumbersome procedures that we have in government. So I'll start off with my first question, which is, what do you think should be the limits of health freedom, if any limits?
Oh, well, I'll bite. get us started here. Or Debbie, if you have something you want to jump in with that one, by all means. My first thought...
Go ahead.
My first thought, Greg, is... In the real world, there are people, situations, and circumstances where it could be very helpful to have a sort of fallback, I don't know what you want to call it, safety net or reinforcement or what have you. I mean, I think to one degree or another, I think it's sort of a given that humans, not only socially, but just practically and pragmatically, are social beings that necessarily are interdependent to one degree or another. And that sort of interdependence gives rise to a need of some sort of structure, at least minimally, for us socially. And that usually takes the form, or at least includes, some kind of legal system, something that creates at least some minimum boundaries of proper behavior as it pertains to, for example, somebody's freedom or freedom of choice imposing on someone else. Okay, so, you know, for vaccines, historically what this means is maybe you have a right to refuse vaccines for religious or other reasons up to some point, but if there's some serious infectious disease risk or threat, the state has the right to step in and say, no, you can't have this exemption anymore because you have to be vaccinated to protect yourself and everyone else. The concern for me philosophically is not that there should be no state or no right for the state to intervene, but where should those boundaries be? Because as soon as you create a system where somebody has the opportunity to step in and tell you what to do or what you can't do, there is some potential, theoretically or hypothetically, for that authority to be misused, whether deliberately or not, or worse, to be abused, deliberately misused for an improper motive or purpose or reason that can harm others. And so, to me, it's a balance. There needs to be some degree for the state to step in. You know, when you have the rare instance when a parent absolutely refuses to give a child any medical treatment at all because it's against their religious beliefs, and the child's life could be saved if they got medical treatment, I think most people would say, well, we should really override that parent's religious freedom or religious choices to save the child's life. And I suppose we could have a conversation about if or when or why you should or does it or doesn't matter if you do that or not. You know, maybe the child is better if they go to God sooner or whatever. But I would prefer not to get into that discussion at the moment because I think it's kind of a side question. But for me, the issue is, how do you balance the need for the state or someone to be able to intervene in the extreme situations where somebody, let's say presumably just for the sake of discussion, where somebody's going to make a decision or fail to make a decision because of a mental ill health. Let's not even attach it to religion. Somebody, for reasons of ill health, doesn't take care of their child to save their life, then somebody needs to be able to step in and protect that child. On the other hand, you know, where is the limit so that we can minimize as much as possible the misuse or abuse, especially the deliberate misuse and or abuse of authority and power, because that's harmful too. How do we balance these sort of competing needs? And it's, you know, there might be a range of different answers to that question. But I guess my answer to your question is we need to balance these competing needs. And then I think the society we have today errs heavily on the side of assuming that the authorities always act in good faith based on proper information and are going to always do the right thing, and it doesn't, the current system just doesn't really acknowledge the reality of the extent to which corruption and ill intent and so forth actually exists and takes place.
Very interesting answer. And how about you, Debbie? What are your thoughts? What should be the limit?
Okay. I think that Alan has a very succinct legal perspective and answer. And when I think about your questions, I always imagine a utopian society. And when I think of that, I think of a loving, kind world, which brings me to Mother Teresa. And if I were to read all of the most famous quotes by her, it it's a combination of this chain between and link, this chain link of peace and love and being wanted and nurtured, eliminating poverty. And I think that at the root of all of this is that we have, we're in service to people, we're in service to others. And I think that we need such a positive message sent out across the entire globe. Like if I could sprinkle dust of just love, that to me is important, which means when you come to the Constitution, the right to freedom and happiness. And so she says, spread love everywhere you go. Let no one ever come to you without leaving happier, which means that in terms of the law, it should, we should be able to come away with something that makes us feel satisfied that our needs are met, we have been heard, and the law protects us, so that that is true. I don't know whether that answers your question, but that's my, those are my thoughts for this question.
All right. Yeah, I like that too. Yeah, the way that I answer the question is in a bureaucratic manner. Like it's just sort of logical and hierarchical. Like the first thing that the law will do, it will classify you. Say, are you a hospital employee? Are you a government employee? Are you a citizen of a particular state? And then once you're properly classified as being either employed in some function or whether you're a private citizen, then you get – the next question is what authority would require you to lose any health freedom? Because there's definitely a right to health freedom. It's, the California Constitution summarizes it well, where it explains that everyone has the inalienable right to be – to be free in their person. And it's, I'll quote it for you. All people are by nature free and independent and have inalienable rights. Among these are enjoying and defending life and liberty and pursuing and obtaining safety, happiness, and privacy. So we have all of these rights. And then once the government decides that it wants to infringe upon your health freedom, the way that it does so is first by classifying you, and then second by invoking a statute or some authority which will try to take away that right. And it's done, and it can only be done systematically. It can only be done by under pretenses that you have been given a fair hearing, that you've been given notice of the matter, that you have, you know, an opportunity to defend yourself. And then only after all of these procedures do you lose your health freedom. So the question of so my original question is, what should be the limits of health freedom? And if I had to sum it up in two words, it would be due process is the limit. And the more extensive answer is that the limit is with regard to, number one, the way that you conduct your life, and number two, what procedures are in play against your classification. Yeah. So hopefully that helps show how bureaucratic and institutionalized it is. One of the nice things about a bureaucracy is that it tends to treat everyone evenly. You know, it doesn't really care who you are, how much money you have.
Does it treat people evenly, equitably? Which is it?
Well, I think what we could do is look especially to historical examples to try to see if people have been treated equally. And in times of fear, people are not treated equally. Like I can point to the example in World War II of Japanese internment of Japanese citizens, or in San Francisco around the turn of the century where it was Chinese citizens who were interned in camps because of suspicion of disease, and it only aggravated the disease. And then I can point to older examples where it was fear of diseases coming over through the ports, through the ship ports. And so they would implement these quarantines on ships that would come into harbor where they had to be docked for upwards of 2 weeks, and everyone, you know, would be searched on board and, you know, just made sure that no one could even leave the ship if they had any signs or symptoms of disease. And so what you can see there is the early manifestations of this classification, where you know, if you're a sailor, then you have been classified. And then the regulation upon you is called the quaranta, which it's Latin for 40 days, which was the original quarantine. In the modern world, if you go back biblically, it's different. And then when you have this classification and regulation, then you have the implementation by local authorities. And that was the duty to maintain public health has traditionally in America been maintained by local authorities rather than national. And we are slowly getting to a point where that is shifting, and especially so depending on the nature of the threat. If you have a terrorism threat, like a, you know, let's say a bioterrorism threat of smallpox, that is immediately going to trigger national protection guidelines. So it's going to be regulatory and handled that way. So it'll be federal regulations that filter down through the states, and there are whole mechanisms in place to implement the protection against that threat. And it's done primarily, interestingly enough, through the money, through funding mechanisms.
I didn't know you were still talking. Does this mean that a person's individual rights will be put subservient because you as an individual may not have the same health need of precaution of a particular disease that maybe more of your culture would?
Well,
like you're saying, they're coming into a port and they're afraid. But what if you as an individual in your family does not propose have a threat to disease?
That would not be something that would be recognized by the law, because there would be an individual inquiry to the person as to whether they are susceptible or not susceptible to disease. Wouldn't look at family history, or at least I can't think of any examples where that has ever happened. It's just a matter of if you're in a population pool, like citizens of New York or citizens of Baltimore, and there's a threat ongoing, then everyone, in some cases, has been required to engage in certain public health measures. And that's what caused the famous Supreme Court case on this topic, case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. Alan and I have discussed this at length. There was a smallpox outbreak in Massachusetts in a town called Cambridge. And there was a preacher and his son who said, well, we're not going to get this vaccine. And so, but the local health board had said, if you don't get the vaccine, you have to pay a fine of $5 or you can leave the jurisdiction. And the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the government, which so basically they required the preacher to pay $5 so that he wouldn't have to get the vaccine. And the whole premise of the case was, what's the balance between the public health authority of Massachusetts versus the individual right? And the preacher had raised the point about his own personal susceptibility to disease, saying, vaccines are unsafe, this is going to have an adverse effect on me. I think he'd even previously raised how he had had an adverse reaction in the past. And the court said that doesn't affect the underlying authority of Massachusetts to enact regulations, which would require vaccination. And the case has had different interpretations over the years by different authorities. And so today we're left with a situation where if you find yourself confronted with the military medical complex, you know, the big systems, and you can't get churned by it, you can expect their interpretations to favor sort of a one-size-fits-all approach that, you know, if you want to prevent the flu, then you should get a flu shot. They do not care about organic food and medicine. If there is a smallpox outbreak, you should get a smallpox vaccine. Could care less about what naturopathic practitioners have in response to smallpox. And so, because that's the way that that system operates, which actually is a good segue to my next question, which is... So the next question is, who should have the authority over deciding these health questions? Traditionally, it was local. And then, as I just pointed out, we have national when it comes to terrorism events. And then there's also the international, which is, you know, the United Nations and matters governed by treaty, where you have certain organizations, like primarily the World Health Organization. They were created in 1963, and their stated goal is to promote the health of the public. That sounds a lot like, you know, our local public health programs, right? It's to promote the health of the public. And they, you know, quote, to achieve food security for all and to make sure people have regular access to enough high-quality food to lead active, healthy lives. And they do what's called, quote, science-based decisions. But when we look closer at what's actually going on in these international departments, these international regulatory bodies, they're promoting the same solutions that are promoted by industry. So, you know, only a drug can cure you. Food should be irradiated, you know, to sterilize it, and promoting the pharmaceutical agenda of vaccines and so forth. And so, you know, it's an institutionalized system. It's kind of like, you know, if I had to draw an analogy, I'd say it's kind of like a beast, where a beast will just, you know, attack things that are in its path, or just, you know, trample them through, because that's what a beast does. You know, it's like trying to tell an elephant to be a mouse. It just doesn't work. You know, you can't tell the United Nations not to, you know, to change. It's just a beast. You know, you just have to look at it and see it for what it is. And if that's the case and you know that, then the goal is to stay out of the path of this beast. And try to avoid being classified by it. You know, try to, you know, learn its methods, understand how it works. And so the more that you can stay off, you know, off the grid, out of the system, promoting your own health, the less likely you are to be trampled by the beast.
Well, I'd love to dive in.
Can I ask a question too?
well, we still have another question outstanding there, but go ahead.
Oh. Well, I didn't really even get it was a question. It sounded like an answer. When the authorities or even the news media report that we now have an epidemic of measles outbreak, and they cite 13 cases, that it was 2, and now there's 13, and they're reporting on the news on TV and on the internet that we are now looking at an epidemic and you must vaccinate your children against this deadly, horrendous disease. Can you, you know, just respond to that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. That's not an epidemic, but that's what they're claiming. They put right. that news out there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and these are done by industry publications. Like, for example, if you want to look up whether it's constitutional to force vaccination, the first thing you'll find is the CDC paper on the matter. And they will cite to published journals, which will rely on statistics like these, where they say, well, there was an outbreak of, you know, so many cases of pertussis, you know, in Los Angeles during this time period. And then they'll look to, you know, what percentage of the population had been vaccinated against it versus what percentage wasn't vaccinated against it. And they say, well, if we just project out, you know, the rate of pertussis outbreak, you know, based on those numbers, then it could be an outbreak, you know, if we let it get loose. And so all you need to do is cite those, you know, those handful of things on their records when they enact the declaration at the local level. It's basically you get, you know, your council together and you have a hearing, and at the hearing you receive evidence like the findings that I just said. And then at the conclusion of the hearing, you call a vote to vote on the measure. And then if you have that evidence that's already on the file, on the record, then your law cannot later be challenged as being unreasonable, because there's a presumption that laws enacted to promote public health are reasonable. And if a person does come along and challenge it, in court, it's very hard to meet the burden to prove that a rule is unreasonable, because the standard is whether it is whether there's any rational basis for the rule, and courts always find that there's a rational basis. Basically, all you have to do is build some record, you know, some published studies, and so that's why these position papers are so important. And you know, as long as you have a regime like the current military-industrial complex, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat; it's all the same. As long as you have a regime that promotes these studies, then the law is meant to protect the regime. The law protects those in power. Now, it also protects minority. It also protects the rights of, you know, minority interests, which is basically the health freedom community. And you know, so your rights are that you have the right to a natural body, and you don't have to be churned through these systems. But it helps to, you know, avoid them, to stay clear of them. Like, for example, if you want to avoid taking a flu shot, as Alan was pointing out in the first part of the program, don't become a healthcare worker. You know, and don't be surprised if they make you wear a mask, which is actually happening to my wife come this November. They're making this rule where she has to wear a mask at work, and because she's not going to do her flu shot. And, you know, it's tough. We see aspects of this. Of these giant systems that treat prevention in a very institutionalized way, and you know, even though she's very healthy and everything, it's just these, you know, these sort of one size fits all rules, and you know, there's just pros and cons to it. Alan, did you have a comment on that as well?
Gosh, you know, 30 or 40, and I think I've lost sight of 29 of them. This is such rich material, and what I mean by that last comment is intended as a compliment. There's such rich material here in terms of so many different parts and pieces to it. I'm going to punt here, though. I'm going to say we're at a break time here and need to take another break, and would love to come back if I can collect my thoughts during the break with a comment or question or two on some of the things you said. I agree with Debbie that where earlier I said there was a question, and she said she thought she heard an answer, and I believe that you had given both a question and an answer. So I think Debbie and I were both right, if I could offer that
sure.
comment. If I could get back to that question, I had a comment on it, and then you've again raised many other fascinating points. So we'll come back to that just a little bit. You're listening to the Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Bruck, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and special guest today and roughly monthly attorney Greg Glazer from California, with some fascinating insights and historical knowledge. As always, Greg, always much appreciated. We're going to go to break. We'll be back in just a little bit. We've got another, I would say, roughly 25 minutes or so for this segment of the show, and then Debbie Bruck, I believe, will take out the last part of the show talking about homeopathy today. So we've got lots of good stuff to talk about, folks. And one of the most important things all of us can do, for example, with the vaccine issue is to keep the conversation alive, and you do that even just by listening to this show. So we really appreciate all of you being here to listen today, and please spread the word to other folks about the show. And, of course, we always welcome calls or even emails during the week with your question. We'll give you those email addresses or contact information on the other side of break when we come back. Debbie, help me remember to do that. And stick around.
Okay, so what do you want me to what do you want me to remind you of?
About how people can email us during the week if they are not able to call into the show live. So, but let's go ahead and get the break taken care of for Freedomizer Radio. And we'll be back in just a little bit, folks. Stay with us.
Hello everyone, Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now, as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house, and Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants. I just love the taste of it, and this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silverleaf Tea. It's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silverleaf Tea.
Bees work tirelessly to provide us with our food, but are struggling in the wild. In recent years, it's become apparent that bees, not just honeybees, are under threat, and some species have already gone extinct. So, be friendly. Check with your local nursery. Plant a bit of paradise for those who do so much.
I saw a little bumblebee. He came and said hello to me. Said, would I like something for me?
You make a difference.
Whatever we can do to encourage people to support bees, I'm for.
Hello again, Freedomist. Proof is here, and I want to talk to you about a brand new soda maker called SodaStream. Now, the Proof House has had SodaStream for about a year, and we love the thing. We use it quite often. With SodaStream, you can have fresh-made soda in seconds. One of the big things we like about it is that there's no high-fructose corn syrup and no aspartame. There's over 60 flavors, or you can create your own. Not just sodas, they also have iced teas and energy drinks. Here at the Proof House, we make egg cream sodas all the time. Some other facts to consider here: there's no electricity, no more wasted bottles and cans, and the most important thing is that it tastes great. Keep in mind, too, this is a perfect family present for Christmas, or, hey, just surprise the family with something great. Also, for a limited time, there's free shipping, so go to freedomizerradio.com and look for the SodaStream link, and I hope you check out the product. That's SodaStream right on freedomizerradio.com.
I'm not a lab rat.
My family is not a bunch of lab rats.
I am not a lab rat.
Thanks, Benefix. 80% of the processed food in America has been genetically modified.
That's GMOs. That's GMOs.
You can't even tell what foods contain GMOs at the grocery store.
Because no GMO food labels are required. That makes us the guinea pigs.
Sounds like an experiment to me.
GMOs are scary.
It's up to you.
You're an adult. You can vote.
I can't vote because I'm a kid.
Vote yes. Vote yes. Please vote yes. Santa Cookie.
Freedomizer, you have a voice.
How will you vote when initiatives are added to the ballot in your state?
We're back with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brock, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and special guest today, Greg Glazer, attorney from California. Debbie, I want to take a quick minute here to let folks know how they can reach us. I know they can reach you at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com. I believe I have that correct, but Debbie, please correct me if I'm mistaken on that. That's homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com. You can reach me at attorney@vaccinerights.com. That's attorney@vaccinerights.com. And Greg, would you take a moment, please, to let folks know what you're up to on the internet and how folks can get a hold of you if they'd like to do that?
Yeah, sure. The best way to reach me or participate is through civilactionnetwork.org.
CivilActionNetwork.org. Terrific. Greg, you were talking a few minutes ago. Let me see if I can pull myself back in and recall what I was trying to talk about here. Who should be making the decisions? You know, who should be in charge of saying whether there's a health emergency or what they should do? Am I paraphrasing your question accurately there, or do you remember more precisely what you said?
That's just fine. Yeah. Should it be local, national, or international that controls your health freedom?
I wanted to offer just a comment on that, because I had a lot of thoughts when you asked that, and I have found myself I don't know that I ever thought about that question, frankly, in any precise form years and years ago, but probably would have come up with an answer very different than the answer I have now. And the answer I have now is informed by my awareness of how health authorities manipulate their power to, among other things, and for example, enrich the pharmaceutical industry at the expense and cost of the health of citizens, as opposed to exercising their authority in a consistently, clearly objective way that seeks to maximize the health of individuals and citizens collectively. At least that's certainly my personal and adamant interpretation of what I have seen over the years, especially with the vaccine issue where I've had my focus. And so all of that leads me in the direction of saying, boy, as much as possible, the decision should be focused in the realm of the individual, but that any decision should always be as informed as possible under the circumstances. And I wanted to give an example here, if I'm not getting hopefully too far out of line. The policy in most states, if not all states, as I understand it, is that children in school who are unimmunized because of the exercise of an exemption, in particular, although not limited to those with religious exemptions, are basically told with regard to routine immunizations, you know, okay, you can have the exemption if you qualify and you go through the right procedure, but if there's an outbreak, then, you know, all bets are off and you got to stay home for the incubation period of the disease. So that's often chickenpox comes up a lot, and often chickenpox, someone at school gets the chickenpox, and it's more often than not, and the CDC admits this on their website, more often than not, it's a vaccinated kid. But all the unvaccinated kids have to stay home. And this is just sort of a general policy decision. And I wanted to briefly challenge that decision. I think as it pertains to those kids whose parents have religious exemptions or religious objections to the vaccines, I think it's discriminatory and at a level that could potentially be challenged in court. And my thinking is this, that the CDC tells us that not every child who gets vaccinated develops the desired immune response. And let's assume for the sake of discussion that when they do develop antibodies that amounts to